Media, WYLL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.
It's 1 o'clock, Champaign, Urbana. I'm Bob McChesney. This is WILL AM 580 and Media Matters. I'm your host, coming to you live today, July 17th, and it's time to jump. Our guest today is going to be talking about one of the most extraordinary books I've read in a long time on the state of the United States as a country, and particularly the state of Black America. I urge you to stay with us for the full hour. It's going to be a wonderful program. Until then, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. It's easy to take for granted how important getting online can be. For those living in urban and suburban areas, concerns about internet access have more to do with speed or service outages that disrupt your connectivity. But in many rural communities, getting online at all is a challenge.
Today, 26 million Americans are still without broadband access, and roughly 73% of those individuals are rural residents. They're in your communities. Moreover, one-third of Americans don't subscribe to broadband even when they do have access to it. And in rural America, that gap is even wider. What's the main reason? We know what it is. It's cost. But in addition to that, some don't even know how to use broadband or even acknowledge or know why it's relevant to them. These are the critical factors that are driving the policies that I work on each and every day.
That's Federal Communications Commissioner Minion Clyburn speaking to the National Rural Assembly in late June. This was the third gathering of the Rural Assembly, and while previous convenings focused primarily on education, healthcare, economic development, and natural resources, this year, internet connectivity and broadband issues took center stage.
It is unacceptable to me that so many citizens are being left behind. Rural residents need to have the same access to broadband services and applications as their urban counterparts. Current data cited in the chairman's rural report suggests a correlation between broadband levels and education and income levels. Every American must have the opportunity to tap into the unlimited possibilities that come with high-speed internet access. They need to have broadband offered in their communities and in their homes, and they need to have the ability to purchase it.
Commissioner Clyburn is referencing the oft-discussed digital divide, which separates those with access to affordable high-speed internet from those who lack it. Communities lacking access miss out on opportunities in everything from education to economic development to health care. Ajay El Casa Peralta is the coordinator of the Rural Broadband Policy Group, a growing national coalition of rural advocates for fast, affordable, and reliable internet in rural communities. The group evolved out of earlier gatherings of the Rural Assembly and has been working to address access to and ownership of broadband networks. Casa Peralta says that it was important for the assembly attendees to hear from a policymaker who had rural roots.
Because I think that's something we don't hear often within the media justice or media reform field, is that people who are leading this work are rural and understand the challenges and the opportunities that rural communities offer. She mentioned no matter how small a community is, they still need access to broadband. And so that's really key for rural communities, because the reason why a lot of big corporations don't come out to rural areas is because we're dispersed, right? So there's like big pieces of land between us, and we're small in numbers, so then we're not profitable.
Casa Peralta explained that accessing the internet was not just about checking your email or banking online. Internet access is necessary in today's life. Many social services are going online, and in rural communities where there is less infrastructure, like hospitals or schools, access to the internet becomes even more critical.
I mean, all of these things that are not focused on the technology itself, but the success of a community and the development of a community and the opportunities that a community can have is what I think we heard throughout all of the sessions. You know, what this really means for people and for the future of this community. So it really speaks to community survival.
Amalia Deloney is the grassroots policy director of the Center for Media Justice, who helped coordinate several listening sessions and breakouts on broadband issues. Deloney says that it became clear in these conversations that attendees knew what was at stake, but were also well aware of the specific policy obstacles they faced.
State legislation that prohibits municipal broadband networks for communities not to have ownership and control over their own networks, eligibility requirements for broadband funding, the unevenness in federal funding. So when you look at population density or scale, you know, how this disproportionately impacts rural communities.
The Rural Broadband Policy Group is compiling the results of these conversations from the Assembly into a report that will be out next week. You can find out more and read the report at ruralassembly.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580. In the course of doing this program over the last 9 years, and in the course of doing my job as a professor, I get the chance to read lots of books. Some are very good, some aren't very good. And every now and then a book comes along that is so striking and so interesting to me and so important and so compelling that I try to make sure I get the author of the book on the air with me for an hour of Media Matters. That's the case with today's book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. And I'm honored to have the author of that book, Michelle Alexander, professor at Ohio State University, a professor of law, here to talk about the book with us for the full hour. Professor Alexander, welcome to Media Matters.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on your show.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And I really mean these words. This book, this is a book, in fact, I'll say that I would like to say it's a page turner in the sense that I just devoured it in one sitting. But it was a book, actually, after every 10 or 20 pages, I had to put it down and sort of think about what was said. Not that it was difficult writing, but it was at times very provocative and compelling. And so instead of me praising it, let's let you talk about it. Why did you write this book, and what's your basic thesis?
Well, I decided to write the book really after years of working as a civil rights lawyer and advocate and having a series of experiences that began what I call my awakening. I began to awaken to a racial reality that I had been blind to for a long time, but that suddenly became obvious to me. I came to see that our criminal justice system functions more like a caste system than a system of crime control, and that, you know, just decades after the end of the old Jim Crow, and even in the age of Obama, something akin to a racial caste system had, in fact, been born again in America. And I think because my own awakening was so jarring to me that I became increasingly concerned by the blindness and indifference of other civil rights advocates around me to the fact that mass incarceration was happening on our watch and scarcely little was being done or said about it. So I wrote the book with the hope that it would allow others, people who care about social and racial justice but do not yet fully understand the impact of mass incarceration in poor communities of color and the true reasons it came about, will have the same awakening process that I did and commit themselves to being part of the necessary efforts to bring it to an end.
You mentioned Jim Crow, Professor Alexander. That's a term I think most Americans are familiar with, at least I hope so. But maybe you could tell a little bit more about what Jim Crow is and then why specifically you picked that as the analogy or metaphor to use for your book.
Yes, well, Jim Crow was a period following slavery in which African Americans in the South were relegated to a permanent second-class status by law. It was a system of rules, laws, policies, practices, and customs that operated to enforce legal racial segregation and legal discrimination, as well as disenfranchisement against African Americans, barring black folks from the vote through poll taxes and literacy tests, segregating them in schools, separate water fountains, separate bathrooms. I believe mass incarceration is a new Jim Crow because millions of African Americans, particularly black men, have been swept into the criminal justice system over the past few decades for reasons not related to crime rates, swept into criminal justice system, branded criminals and felons, and then released into a permanent second-class status in which they are denied many of the rights supposedly won in the civil rights movement, including the right to vote, the right to serve on juries, and the right to be free from legal discrimination in employment, housing, access to education, and public benefits. So many of the old forms of discrimination that we supposedly left behind during the Jim Crow era are suddenly legal again once you've been branded a felon. That's why I say we haven't ended racial caste in America. We've just redesigned it.
As I read your book, Professor Alexander, I was repeatedly stunned by some of the statistics and data you've assembled in the book. And I think I pay fairly close attention to this, so I could just imagine how this would sound to someone who maybe hasn't really focused on this issue at all. Give some sense, if you would, about the extent of the prison system into the black community. I mean, when you talk about the loss of rights that felons have for the rest of their lives, I mean, you do a very dramatic job in the book of explaining that this really is formal legalized discrimination in a way that, again, Jim Crow once had, but we have again.
Yes, absolutely. Well, you know, the scale of this system is staggering. You know, our prison population quintupled in the period of about, 30 years, a little less than 30 years. We went from a prison population of about 300,000 to well over 2 million. And the majority of that increase was poor people of color. And the reason for the prison explosion had very little to do with crime rates. You know, crime rates have actually fluctuated during the past 30 years, gone up, gone down. Today, as bad as crime is in many parts of the country, crime rates are actually at historical lows. But incarceration rates, especially black incarceration rates, have consistently soared. You know, most criminologists and sociologists today will acknowledge that crime rates and incarceration rates in the United States have moved independently of one another. Incarceration rates have soared for black men in particular, regardless of whether crime is going up or down in any given community or the nation as a whole. No group has been more affected by mass incarceration than African Americans. And the result is that today, there are more African Americans under correctional control in prison or jail, on probation or parole, than were enslaved in 1850, a decade before the Civil War began. In some, urban areas, major urban areas like Chicago, more than half of working-age African American men have criminal records and are thus subject to legalized discrimination for the rest of their lives. These folks are part of a growing undercaste, not class, but caste, a group of people defined largely by race who are relegated to a permanent second-class status by law. Barred from employment, many job categories are off-limits to people who have felony records, and discrimination in employment is perfectly legal. You know, virtually every job application has that box you've got to check asking the dreaded question, have you ever been convicted of a felony? And, most people are well aware that if you check that box, there's virtually no hope of getting a job. People with criminal records may be barred from public housing. In fact, when people are released from prison and they want to go home to their families, to their partners, their children, to their parents, their families risk eviction if they allow their loved one to come home. Even food stamps may be off limits to you if you've been convicted of a drug felony. Under federal law, you're barred from food stamps for the rest of your life if you have a drug conviction. Fortunately, many states have opted out of that food stamp ban, but thousands of people can't even get food stamps, can't feed themselves because they were once branded a felon. So, you know, there are just myriad rules, laws, policies, and practices that operate to lock people who've been branded criminals and felons into a permanent second-class status for life.
Our guest, Michelle Alexander, professor of law at The Ohio State University in Columbus and author of the new book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Color Blindness, published by The New Press in 2010. She's our guest live on the program today, so if you'd like to call in with questions or comments, the number here at Media Matters is 333-9455, our area code, of course, 217, or the toll-free line is open at 1-800-222-9455. And very soon in your book, if not right at the beginning, Professor Alexander, and a theme throughout the book that we haven't even talked about yet, but which is really crucial to understanding this prison explosion, has been the drug war.
Yes.
And the way I think you compellingly argue it has been fought in an extraordinarily discriminatory manner. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. The drug war has really been the engine of mass incarceration. The drug war has been waged almost exclusively in poor communities of color, even though studies have consistently shown for decades that, contrary to popular belief, people of color are no more likely to use or sell illegal drugs than whites. Now, that defies basic racial stereotypes about who drug dealers are. You know, when we imagine a drug dealer, we imagine, you know, some black kid standing on the street corner with his pants sagging down. Plenty of drug dealing does happen in the ghetto, in the hood, but it happens everywhere else in America as well. You know, a kid who's living in rural Kansas or rural Illinois doesn't drive to the hood to get their marijuana or their meth or their cocaine. Most likely they get it from someone of their own race down the road. You know, it turns out that drug markets, much like American society generally, are fairly segregated by race. Black folks tend to sell drugs to black folks, Latinos to each other, whites to each other. People of all races use and sell drugs at remarkably similar rates, but the enemy in this war has been racially defined. Not by accident, this drug war has been focused almost exclusively on poor communities of color, particularly black men and increasingly Latinos as well.
You know, one of the statistics that you have in the book that rings home here in Illinois is that 90% roughly of the people who go to prison for drug offenses in the state of Illinois are African American.
That's right.
That is,
absolutely no relationship whatsoever to their rates of, you know, the rates of use or sales of drugs in Illinois.
And, you know, let's talk a little bit, why is that? Why is this drug war being fought in such an uneven manner?
Well, most people imagine that the reason the drug war is focused in ghetto communities and poor communities of color is because that's where the violent offenders can be found. That's, you know, where the drug kingpins can be found. In fact, in my experience, most people imagine that the war on drugs was declared in response to the emergence of crack cocaine in inner city communities and the related violence. But that's not true. President Ronald Reagan declared the current drug war in 1982 at a time when drug crime was on the decline, not on the rise. Now, President Richard Nixon was the first to coin the term a war on drugs But it was President Ronald Reagan who turned that rhetorical war into a literal one. And at the time he declared the drug war, drug abuse and drug crime was actually on the decline, not on the rise. It was before, not after, crack hit the streets and became a media sensation. The war on drugs, from the outset, numerous historians and political scientists, you know, have now documented that the war on drugs from the outset was part of a grand political strategy known as the Southern Strategy, embraced by conservatives in an effort to flip the South from blue to red. The Southern Strategy was an effort to use racially coded, racially charged, get-tough appeals on issues of crime and welfare to appeal to poor and working-class whites in the South who were anxious about, fearful of, resentful of many of the gains of African-Americans in the civil rights movement. And to be fair, I think we have to acknowledge that, you know, poor and working-class whites really had their world rocked by the civil rights movement. You know, wealthy whites could send their kids to private schools, could give their kids all of the, you know, advantages that wealth has to offer. But poor and working class whites in the wake of the civil rights movement were faced with a social demotion. It was their kids who might potentially be bused across town to a school they believed was inferior to them. It was their kids who were forced to compete on equal terms for scarce jobs with this whole new group of people they've been taught their whole lives to believe were inferior to them. And then to make matters worse, affirmative action programs were creating the impression that black folks were now leapfrogging over them on their way to Harvard and Yale. And, you know, these circumstances created an enormous amount of anxiety, fear, and resentment. But they also created an enormous political opportunity. Pollsters and political strategists found that using these racially coded, racially charged, get-tough appeals on issues of crime and welfare, they could successfully persuade poor and working-class whites to defect from the Democratic Party, from the Democratic New Deal Coalition, and join the Republican Party in droves. And so when President Reagan declared his war on drugs, it was an effort to make good on campaign promises, to get tough on a group of people not so subtly defined as black, brown. And then when crack emerged a couple years later, the Reagan administration seized on this development with glee, actually hiring staff whose job it was to publicize inner city crack babies, crack dealers, crack users, and the related violence in the hopes of turning crack into a media sensation and bolstering public support for a drug war they had already declared.
Professor Alexander, before we go to the phone lines for waiting callers, I do want to just get to one issue that jumps out of what you were just talking about that's in the book and I think is especially important today, which is the percentage or number of African Americans who are no longer permitted to vote, even if they've done their time, or even if they're doing their time, no longer permitted to vote, and how that affects the outcome of our elections. And I'd like you also to talk about that with the more recent developments of the last year, where we're seeing in virtually every state in the country where there's Republican control of the state legislature and a Republican governor, they're instituting draconian changes to make it much more difficult for people to vote. With, as far as I can tell, and I've been studying this fairly closely, no evidence whatsoever that the proposed reforms would actually do away with what they call voter fraud, but would certainly do away with getting poor people to vote.
Yes, absolutely. Well, you know, due to felon disenfranchisement laws today, nearly one in eight African-American men are denied the right to vote, and in some areas it's more like one in four. And, you know, it was reported back in 2000 when, you know, Gore famously had the election stolen from him by the U.S. Supreme Court. It was, you know, reported back in 2000 that if people who had felony convictions in Florida had been allowed to vote, Gore would have, you know, won handily. But, you know, because such a large segment of the African American community was disenfranchised due to felon disenfranchisement laws, it became possible for them to give the election to Bush. So, you know, it has been well documented now that felon disenfranchisement has had a really disastrous impact on the African American community's ability to exercise political power, and that it has, you know, affected the outcome of, you know, numerous elections, large and small. And, you know, certainly the city council and school board elections are often as important, if not more important, to the lives of folks in individual communities than the presidential election. And in many communities, such large percentages of the population have been branded felons, often due largely to the drug war many elections have been altered.
And to be clear on the felon convictions, oftentimes, if not a majority of the times, the people who go into the prison system for drug convictions are for possession, and they're oftentimes for possession of marijuana.
Yes. You know, many people, you know, have this misimpression again that the drug war is aimed at rooting out violent offenders or drug kingpins, but nothing could be further from the truth. The overwhelming majority of people who are arrested and convicted of drug offenses are convicted of extremely minor drug offenses. For example, in 2005, 4 out of 5 drug offenses were for simple, you know, possession, only 1 out of 5 for sales. Most people in state prison for drug offenses have no history of violence or significant selling activity. And in the 1990s, the period of the greatest escalation of the drug war, nearly 80% of the increase in drug arrests were for marijuana possession, a drug less harmful than alcohol or tobacco, and at least as prevalent in middle-class white communities and on college campuses and universities as it is in the hood. And many people ask me, you know, why would law enforcement focus so heavily on these extremely minor drug offenses rather than concentrating their energies on the violent offenders, the people who, you know, pose greater risks of harm to the community? And the answer is simple: cash. Law enforcement agencies get rewarded in cash by the federal government for the sheer numbers of drug arrests. It's a numbers game. They don't get rewarded in cash for bringing down the drug kingpins or the most violent offenders. They get rewarded through federal grant programs like the Edward Byrne Memorial Grant Program and others for the sheer numbers of people swept into the system for drug offenses, you know, guaranteeing that law enforcement goes out looking for the so-called low-hanging fruit, sweeping poor communities of color, stopping, frisking, tossing as many folks on the street, pulling their vehicles over, searching their cars to boost their numbers up as part of this drug war.
Our guest, Michelle Alexander, professor of law at Ohio State University, author of the new book, or one-year-old book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Color Blindness, published by the New Press. The phone lines are open. We're coming to you live today in WILL AM 580. Our phone number is 217-333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. We have a couple of callers who've been waiting very patiently. Let's start with them right now. Let's first go to Charleston, line one. You're on the air with Professor Alexander.
Yes, first I just want to thank Professor Alexander for making the effort to write this book. I think a lot of people know little bits and pieces of the overall picture, but you did a very good job, a disturbing job of showing what's happening to a lot of people in this country. The question I want to ask, I have so many, but I guess the question I'll ask is, well, first off, if you will just, when you have some time, comment on how Supreme Court decisions have also impacted the status of African Americans. You talk about that in your book. But the question I want to ask is, I think I read the book about a year ago. it doesn't seem to me that it's gotten much attention, but I'm just wondering, have you seen anything happen as a result of your book that's made you glad that you wrote it?
Well,
thank you very much, caller, for your call. Professor Alexander, proceed.
Yes, well, I knew when I wrote the book that it was very unlikely that it would attract any attention in the mainstream media, which is, you know, very much committed to kind of the post-racial narrative about, you know, our nation's racial presence. And, you know, I think also it was clear to me that this notion that we have a caste-like system operating in the United States would seem just implausible to many, and that, you know, the mainstream media would stay away from it. But what I am very gratified by, though, is that there's been a tremendous kind of outpouring of grassroots support for the book. You know, there have numerous churches, mosques, grassroots organizations that have really kind of rallied to the cause and helped to ensure that the message of the book reaches people and communities who would benefit from the information most. There's an organization called the Samuel DeWitt Proctor Conference, which is a network of thousands of progressive black churches who have now made ending mass incarceration their number one priority and are forming study groups based on the book in churches around the country, and are holding a series of convenings over the next several months that where faith leaders will come together to help develop a common vision and strategy for mobilizing their congregations politically to end mass incarceration, the drug war, and all these forms of legal discrimination that keep people locked in a permanent second-class status. And grassroots organizations are forming around the country to respond to many of the issues that I've described in the book. And so I do have hope that the sleeping giant is waking, and that, you know, people who do read the book and have this kind of awakening that I describe come to recognize their own power, because after all, it is the silence about this system and the harms that it has caused that has allowed it to endure for so long, which reminds me that I would like to say a bit about the role of shame in a minute. The way shame...
Certainly, go. Why don't you do it right now?
All right. Well, you know, one of the things I describe in the book is the fact that people who have been labeled criminals and felons experience so much stigma and shame that it keeps the community's hardest hit by mass incarceration silent and very much divided. You know, there was a study done, actually, in Washington, D.C., of the communities hardest hit by mass incarceration. I mean, these are communities where nearly every house or every, you know, apartment has a family member who is either currently behind bars or recently released from prison. I mean, neighborhoods where experience of incarceration is so pervasive that you would just imagine that people in these neighborhoods would be talking all the time about who's in and who's out. But in this ethnographic study, they were unable to find one person in these communities who had fully come out to their friends, neighbors, or loved ones about their own criminal history or the status of their loved ones. There was so much shame and denial that even a child, when asked by a relative, where's your daddy, would say, oh, my daddy, I don't know where my daddy is, knowing full well he was in prison. People, when asked by friends or neighbors, oh, where have you been? I haven't seen you for years. Where have you been? How are you doing? I haven't seen you in so long. Where have you been? Would get the response, oh, you know, I've been out of town. I've been away. I've been doing this. I've been doing that. I'll talk to you later. There was so much shame and stigma that it creates a silence in the communities most affected by mass incarceration. And many churches are places where that stigma and shame is intensified, where there's a lot of blaming and shaming of those who find themselves trapped within this system. And this shame and blame makes collective political action next to impossible. So one of the things that I think is most important is that we begin creating safe places in communities hard hit by mass incarceration for people to begin speaking openly about their own experience of incarceration or that of their family members, and for us all to begin admitting our own criminality out loud. I mean, after all, we are all criminals. All of us have broken the law at some point. I often say if the worst thing you've ever done in your whole life is speed 10 miles over the speed limit, you've put yourself and others at more risk of harm than someone smoking marijuana in the privacy of their living room. But there are people in the United States doing life sentences for first-time drug offenses, a practice the U.S. Supreme Court upheld against a challenge, that sentencing people to life in prison for a first-time drug offense was cruel and unusual punishment. The Supreme Court said, no, it does not violate the Eighth Amendment ban on cruel and unusual punishments, even though virtually no other country in the world does such a thing.
Professor Alexander, let me just stop you there, because that gets to the second part of the caller's question, which is the U.S. Supreme Court and how it's dealt with the drug war. And one of the heart and soul of your book, I think, you have several chapters, and we aren't going to have a chance to go through them, unfortunately, but they're quite important to your whole argument, goes through the entire criminal justice process from arrest to conviction to parole, and demonstrates, I think, convincingly how deeply flawed and unfair the whole process is and how stacked the deck is. And you also, as a constitutional lawyer, go through how the Supreme Court has dealt with all these cases that have come up that have argued that this is unfair. And I think the term that's used, and I don't think it's your term, is the drug exception, mm-hmm. that basically the whole Bill of Rights deals with drugs, they just throw it out the window, it seems like.
Yes, absolutely. The U.S. Supreme Court in a long series of cases effectively shredded the Fourth Amendment protection against unreasonable searches and seizures, giving the police license to stop and search just about anyone, anywhere, for suspected drug crimes. Once upon a time, the police could not just stop, question, interrogate, and frisk you without actual evidence of criminal activity. That's no longer the case. Today, police can do precisely that so long as they get quote-unquote consent. Now, what's consent? Consent is when a police officer approaches someone on the street, let's say a young black kid on the street, walking down the street on his way home from school or from playing basketball with his friends, and approaches them on the street without any evidence of criminal activity whatsoever and with one hand on his gun and says, son, do you mind if I speak to you for a minute? Will you turn around so I can frisk you and see if you've got any drugs on you? And the kid says, uh-huh, and puts his arms up, spreads his legs for the routine stop, frisk, and search. That uh-huh constituted consent. And means that the young man has no Fourth Amendment protection whatsoever against unreasonable searches and seizures. And by eviscerating Fourth Amendment protections in the drug war, the U.S. Supreme Court has given license to the police to sweep entire neighborhoods and communities, stopping, frisking young men over and over and over again, taking their names, fingerprinting them on the streets, entering their information into databases, not because there's any reasonable suspicion of criminal activity or probable cause, but simply because they can. And as a result, the odds of a young man being caught with something, being caught violating the law at some point, are astronomical in poor communities of color, whereas a white kid in the suburbs who drives around with marijuana in his car or commits other minor criminal activity is very unlikely ever to be caught.
Our guest, Michelle Alexander from Ohio State University's Law School and the author of the book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters and WILL AM 580 coming to you live. So the phone lines are open at 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. We have a couple callers who have been waiting very patiently. To them, I apologize. Let's get to them right now. Let's start with line one, Champaign County. You're on the air with Michelle Alexander.
Professor Alexander, yeah, I read your book more than a year ago and enjoyed it. And basically, I have like 3 points to make. One, they mentioned about the right to vote. I know in Illinois, it's in the Illinois Constitution, the person's right to vote is restored automatically upon completion of sentence. And the second is, you mentioned a lot in the book about race, but I think it also has to do with class, because I know some people who had dealings with the legal system, and I think they had misfortune. You know, they were basically poor white folks. So it just seems like you have the deck stacked against you when you don't have any money and everything. And the third is, I think probably the more important is, you know, you have this kind of lack of outrage on the part of, like, the media that, you know, you could find plenty of people, commentators, you know, former prosecutors and so on, like the case down in Florida. But you don't find anybody who get outraged even in cases of people who have been wrongly convicted. You know, you don't have any politicians, you know. You find plenty of politicians who are ex-prosecutors, but I'm not aware of anybody who's been a criminal defense attorney or, you know, public defender. So I think, you know, those are, I think, important points and everything. Again, I enjoyed your book and everything, and I think the situation is, it just seems like I think it's kind of more of a class issue and everything, you know, regarding poor people, because they want certain people to vote and everything, and they don't want other people to vote.
Well, thank you very much, caller. I appreciate that. And Professor Alexander, you discussed that very issue, I think, in some detail in the last portion of your book. Is it class, or where do white people fit into the new Jim Crow?
Yes, well, you know, first I want to thank the caller for, you know, reminding listeners that in Illinois, at least, people can vote following release from prison. I try to remember that when I'm speaking in states where people actually can vote, it's important to remind them that it's possible to do so, since there is often a lot of confusion. Many people who are eligible to vote don't know they are. And so I appreciate that reminder for those who are listening. And it certainly is true that poor people have the deck stacked against them in the criminal justice system, that this isn't just about race. It's also about class. But when you talk about when you think about the war on drugs, race is the overwhelming factor in the drug war. You know, you have 90% of people who are doing prison time in Illinois for drug offenses being African American, and that cannot be explained simply by class. Race has been the driving factor in the war on drugs, as all of the data clearly evidences that this drug war has been waged almost exclusively in poor communities of color, even though rates of drug use and sales are equal across the board. But, you know, in many of those, there are white folks who are hurting because of the drug war. It's not the case that 100% of people who are serving time for drug offenses are African American or Latino. There are some white folks who who have been harmed by the drug war. And in the book, as I argue in the book, you know, white folks who are serving long mandatory minimum sentences for minor drug offenses are essentially collateral damage in this drug war. They weren't the primary targets, but they are suffering as well. And while, you know, describing white folks who are hurting in the drug war as collateral damage may sound callous, it does reflect, I think, a certain political reality, which is the drug war would not have been declared but for the racial politics that gave rise to it. And the frenzy, the media frenzy, and the millions and then billions of dollars that were devoted to waging the drug war None of that would have occurred but for the racialization of crime in the media and the public discourse. So we have an interesting situation here in the United States where it may be possible for the first time for white people to begin to see more clearly how they can be harmed by racial caste systems aimed at poor folks of color. I think one of the things that has been underexplored in the scholarly literature is the ways whites were harmed by the old Jim Crow. Now, obviously, they were harmed in ways far less severe, but the reality is that the Jim Crow system harmed whites as well as blacks, but the overtly racial nature of it and the horrific violence aimed at blacks during Jim Crow in many ways obscured the fact that the Jim Crow system, drove down wages, defined certain categories of jobs in ways that limited them to poor folks of color, in ways that harmed all poor and working people. And so, with the drug war, I think we may have an opportunity to see how these racially biased caste systems can operate to harm people in communities of all colors.
Professor Alexander, before we get back to a number of very patient people waiting to talk to you on the phone, real quickly, the caller also mentioned media coverage, and this is a theme throughout the book, how the news media have covered this story as a rule. And if you just make a couple general comments, it'd be appreciated.
Yes. Well, the media has played an enormous role. After the emergence of crack cocaine and the media campaign launched by the Reagan administration to associate in the public imagination crack with African Americans, once that association was made, it led to a wave of punitiveness aimed at poor people of color. And the media has played an outsized role in sustaining the connection between, blacks and crimes, African Americans, and illegal drugs. And that imagery and those associations drive both our conscious and unconscious thinking individually and collectively about who the criminals are and what should be done with them.
Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 4, Ottawa, thank you very much for your patience. You're on the air with Michelle Alexander.
Yeah, Bob, this is an incredibly interesting subject today. But anyway, I'd like to ask the professor, through her research, did she ever, who are the architects of these policies? How far up does it go? Does she think that President Reagan was consciously do what he was doing or doing their bidding? I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Thank you very much, caller. Michelle Alexander?
Well, I think it's important to emphasize that, when I compare mass incarceration to Jim Crow, I am in no way suggesting that everyone who is in law enforcement or all legislators, et cetera, who have supported Get Tough legislation are biased in the old Jim Crow sense. There are many people who, believe that they are serving their communities well, who nonetheless support policies that are incredibly damaging and discriminatory. But as I describe in the first chapter of the book in some detail, the political strategy that led to the war on drugs was adopted very consciously by conservatives and many former segregationists who believed that using law and order rhetoric and get tough rhetoric would appeal to those poor and working class whites who were angry about and threatened by many of the gains of African Americans in the civil rights movement. That was a deliberate political strategy. In the words of H.R. Haldeman, President Richard Nixon's former chief of staff, H.R. Haldeman, wrote in his diaries, quote, Nixon believed that the whole problem is really the blacks. The key is to devise a system that recognizes this while not appearing to, end quote. So there was a conscious effort to develop a system and a politics that would mobilize racial resentment
You know, that leads, if I hate to interrupt, you on that point, Professor Alexander, but we have so many people, so many questions. Okay. But this leads to a point that, you know, that's one political party, and they've successfully won elections, perhaps, with that program. But there's another political party, and it seems striking that the Democratic Party, under Bill Clinton, under the Democratic leadership in Congress and various state houses, has hardly put up any opposition to this sort of drug war. In fact, has advanced it, hasn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. As, you know, I emphasize in the book that, you know, after the Reagan administration proved so successful in mobilizing white racial resentment and persuading so many folks to defect from the Democratic Party and join the Republican Party, you know, using this get tough rhetoric, the Clinton administration tried to prove that they could be even tougher than their Republican counterparts on them. And so it was the Clinton administration that escalated the drug war far beyond what his Republican predecessors even dreamed possible. And it was the Clinton administration that championed laws barring, you know, drug offenders from public housing, barring them even from food stamps, barring them from federal financial aid for schooling upon their release. To a large extent, many of the laws that constitute the basic architecture of this new caste system were championed by a Democratic administration in their effort to win back those elusive white swing voters.
How about President Obama? Has he changed the course?
Sadly, he hasn't changed it much. I'm pleased that he signed legislation reducing the infamous 100-to-1 disparity in sentencing between crack versus powder cocaine to 18-to-1. It should be 1-to-1. There should be no disparity in sentencing. But that was a positive step. But overall, Obama has continued the drug policies of his predecessors.
I mean, there's really no elite debate on this point, is there? I mean, it's everyone in both parties atop our political system. All the pressure is pro-prison system, pro-drug war, and there's just a handful of dissident voices, but they're on the outside.
That's exactly right, which is why I argue in the last chapter that nothing short of a major social movement has any hope of ending mass incarceration in the United States. I mean, if we were to return to the rates of incarceration that we had in the 1970s, before the war on drugs and the Get Tough movement really gained steam, if we were to return to those rates of incarceration, we would have to release 4 out of 5 people who are in prison today. More than 1 million people employed by the criminal justice system could lose their jobs. Most new prison construction has occurred in predominantly white rural communities. Those prisons across America would have to close down. This system is now so deeply rooted in our social, political, and economic structure that it's not going to just fade away, even during a time of economic crisis where there have been some meaningful reforms implemented.
We have 2 callers left. I'm going to try to get to both of them. They've both been very patient. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air with Michelle Alexander.
Thank you. I have a caveat and a question. First, I don't believe that civil liberties are instantly and automatically returned to ex-convict upon discharge from prison. I have a friend, not a close friend, but someone I've known for quite a long time, and I distinctly remember that he had great difficulty in receiving a pardon before he could vote or actually run for office. I might add that he and his wife are now community leaders in this area. Secondly, how do you think the role of privatization of prisons has played into this condition?
Great question. Thank you very much, caller. Michelle Alexander?
Thank you for your question. I'm not sure I fully understood your first.
I think he was corroborating your point, actually.
Okay. As for your question, thank you for raising the privatization of prisons. Most prisons today are not private, although if the American Correctional Corporation of America has anything to say about that, that could change in the years to come. Private prisons have been lobbying and donating to politicians who will support get tough measures and harsh mandatory minimum sentences. It was recently reported by NPR, actually just a couple days ago, about how private prison companies are lobbying and even drafting legislation, harsh immigration legislation, because they see kind of their new front in prison building, you know, being warehousing and caging suspected illegal immigrants. Well, you know, they've been doing this for a long time now, lobbying for harsh drug laws, harsh sentencing, three strikes laws, et cetera, right along with the prison guard unions. And many states, prison guard unions are among the largest and most powerful political organizations. And they lobby for mandatory minimum sentences because those long sentences represent job security. So there's a range of private interests that now stand to profit from mass incarceration, including, I might add, a whole range of corporate interests, taser gun manufacturers, private health care providers who provide typically abysmal health care to people in prison, phone companies that gouge prisoners and their families, you know, a whole host of corporate interests, including corporations that employ prisoners, paying them far less than minimum wage, sometimes pennies on the dollar, to, you know, work rather than shipping those jobs overseas. I, you know, often remind people that the 13th Amendment, which abolished slavery, actually has an exception for forced labor in prison. So, you know, in many respects, we see how these the profit motive and these private interests are a big part of why the system has become so deeply entrenched.
We have time for one final caller. Unfortunately, there are callers waiting who I apologize to you right now. But let's go to line two right now for a quick question for Michelle Alexander.
Sure. It's been very comprehensive, and the subjects I wanted to treat have been treated somewhat. But reading Black Agenda report, and citing you, the ratio of powder to crack cocaine was changed by raising that on powder. So it's still a draconian drug response. And I was trying to get the Haldeman diary sites in, and you did have that. But there was actually discussion in the Nixon White House, according to the Haldeman diaries, that it was not just criminalizing the black resistance and the civil rights movement and appealing to lump and proletariat, but it was also a way of targeting the anti-Vietnam War countercultural movement as well. So I just wanted to thank you.
Well, thank you, caller. Michelle Alexander, we've only got about 30 seconds left. You know, we've touched on a lot of things, but I think maybe if you want to just conclude with a few words about politically where we have to go to really get this fundamental crisis addressed. Oops. Professor Alexander, are you there? I think we've lost her, unfortunately, prematurely, regrettably. Our guest today on Media Matters was Michelle Alexander, professor of law at Ohio State University, author of the new book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. I'm Bob McChesney. I'm your host, of course. I want to thank Kyle Kroha, my engineer, Melissa Trentz, my producer. I'm going to be gone the next 3 weeks. We've recorded fresh programs to be aired next week. Dave Zirin talking about sports the week after that. Amy Goodman, and the third week is still up in the air. We've got a few great candidates. Then I'll be back 4 weeks from today with a bunch of live shows in August and thereafter. Everyone, have a great week. Thank you so much for listening to the program, and talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
An excessive heat warning is in effect for our region through the week, with daytime highs in the 90s and heat index values up to 105 to 115. Sunny today, high 92, heat index as high as 103. Partly cloudy, low 74 tonight. Tomorrow, a high of 91 and a heat index as high as 105. This is Illinois Public Media.